from WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A few weeks ago, we offered an anatomy of an historic 40-year-old scoop, the uncovering of the My Lai massacre. This week, we present a more recent one. In December of 2005, the New York Times published an article disclosing the existence of the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program, earning Eric Lischblau and James Risen a Pulitzer Prize. Lischblau's new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice, lays out how he got that story and how the White House tried to squelch it. The story only increased the enmity of the government's law enforcement agencies toward Lischblau once he had fans in the Justice Department, so much so that he was even invited to private, no-press-allowed pickup games of basketball with Attorney General John Ashcroft. But after his front-page story on the FBI's monitoring of anti-war groups in 2003, his press pass at the Justice Department suddenly stopped working, and an internal memo was sent to all of the FBI's field offices instructing officials to freeze him out. Eric, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here you have this really lousy relationship with the Justice Department, and you lay out the tale of getting extremely vague tips about what turned out to be the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. And you suggest that the vagueness and the secrecy of your source, your unnamed source, was in fact inspired by all the president's men's depiction of Deep Throat.
Right. Like the famous credo from All the President's Men, you know, follow the money. They had seen that a few times and thought that they could just sort of tell reporters to go after a hot story and the reporters would ultimately get the story. It doesn't always work that way. Sources were describing programs that perhaps they only saw a sliver of and did not know the full picture. And a lot of times we were just sort of left scratching our heads trying to figure out what we were really looking at here.
So it's 2002. You're at the New York Times, and in the bureau, you're seated across from fellow reporter James Risen. And the person who sat you there said that they were sorry.
Jim can be a little difficult to get along with, and he prides himself in that. That's part of his mystique.
You guys realized that you were, as you say, both pulling on different strands in the same ball of yarn. He was working one half of the NSA warrantless wiretapping story, and you were working the other half.
Right. Jim's focus has always been uncovering the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Mine has always been on the Justice Department domestic side. So we're hearing about different ends of this program from our respective sources, not realizing for quite a while, really, that we were hearing about nervousness emanating from the same program. And it took us a while to put that together. I had really run into a dead end, essentially, and wasn't sure where to turn. Jim put some of the pieces of the puzzle together before I did, as he likes to point out to me endlessly and takes credit for whenever we are together. We then essentially joined forces on this, and we realized that there was a story, and the story led up the road to Fort Meade at the National Security Agency, and Jim went to the administration to tell them what we knew. And that led to a prolonged series of meetings with the administration, urging the newspaper not to run the story.
The administration's first line of attack seems to be, look, there's no story here for you. These programs are entirely legal. All the experts within the administration seem to agree. Congress had been briefed. There were safeguards in place to prevent abuse. It all turned out to be wrong.
Right. The thrust of their arguments from the beginning was that there was never any doubt about the legality of this program, so why run it? That to run a story would simply be outing a vital national security program that had proven essential to saving American lives. And look, that's a powerful and persuasive argument, if true, that any editor is going to listen to two and three times.
Is that why the paper decided not to run the story for more than a year?
Yeah, essentially. You know, we had heard from early on in our reporting that there were, in fact, concerns about the legality of the program, that there was, in fact, resistance within the administration. But those are difficult things to prove. And the editors decided at that early go-round that the national security argument would win out.
Was that supposed to be indefinitely or until new things came to light?
More or less indefinitely. I mean, I was not doing any reporting on it at that point. Jim was not doing any reporting on it. In fact, he went off on sabbatical to write his book.
And you went back to reporting other stories, including covering debates in Congress over whether to renew the Patriot Act. Was it hard for you reporting on this debate, knowing that this 800-pound gorilla that was on the shelf could have changed the debate so drastically?
Yeah, it was frustrating. The Patriot Act was one of the biggest issues before Congress that went to the question of presidential power and checks and balances and how you go about fighting the war on terror. And here was this enormous secret that really went to the heart of what was being debated so publicly by Congress.
And so with the NSA story all but officially dead, James Risen invites you over to his house and shows you a chapter of his book.
He did. He called me over one night and sat me down at his computer and said, hey, take a look at this. There was a working chapter with the title of the program about the NSA program. And I read through it and just kind of sat there silently for a while. Jim talked to the editors at the New York Times to let them know that he was thinking about putting it in his book. And the editors agreed to revisit the whole question of whether or not the story should be published in the newspaper in the first place. It became even clearer that there were deep, deep legal concerns within the administration about the NSA program. We had a pretty good idea of that a year earlier. That became crystal clear in our reporting in 2005. And the editors decided that the reasons to publish now clearly outweighed the reasons not to publish, given that you had a program that some members of the administration believed might be illegal.
And then the New York Times learned that the White House was looking into seeking an injunction against the Times pre-publication. This was all Pentagon Papers style. How did the Times react?
Yeah, the paper had all but decided to publish the story at this point. This was in December 2005. And then I happened to hear that the administration had considered using a Pentagon Papers style injunction, as it had done in 1971, to try and stop publication of the NSA story. That was really a bombshell that quickly helped push the paper to publish the story and to publish it on our website the night before we published it. And we ended up losing the scoop, as it were, because most of our competitors were able to match it, but it was ensured that there could be no injunction to stop the presses.
So after the story ran, you were blasted on the right for running it at all, that blood would be on the New York Times' hands, they said, if a terrorist attack occurred. And the left attacked you for holding the story for 14 months and possibly assisting George W. Bush's reelection.
Every appearance we made was, why didn't you run the story and would this have affected the election? I would leave that to others to decide. But I think it just shows the sensitivity of the story that we got blasted from every corner. I think that time has borne out the decision that the editors made in going ahead with publication. I mean, there's been a serious, serious debate over the last 2.5 years over issues of the president's wartime authority, constitutional powers, separation of powers. This is a debate that we never would have had had the program itself not been disclosed. You hear very few people charging these days that the story should not have run.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Eric Lischblau covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. His new book is called Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice.
And now an update. As we've reported on this show, Associated Press photographer Bilal Hussein has been held by U.S. authorities for 2 years on no particular charges beyond allegations that he had ties to Iraqi insurgents. His photographs were so up close and personal that critics felt he must be up close and personal with the insurgent subjects. But no evidence has been brought forth, and this week an Iraqi judicial committee announced its decision to drop legal proceedings against Hussein, ordering the journalist to be freed. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, it's not clear whether the U.S. authorities will release him or invoke a U.N. mandate that could allow them to continue holding him as a security risk. AP executive editor Kathleen Carroll told us in 2006 that Bilal seems to be regarded by the U.S. military as guilty by association.
Bilal grew up in Fallujah. I don't know about you, but not all the people that I grew up with turned out exactly well. You know, some of them ended up doing things that our mothers might not like. I don't know whether that's the case with Bilal, because we've never had any names associated with this, just they think his relationships are unsavory. Any journalist will tell you that occasionally you end up having dinner with or interviewing or taking pictures of somebody that you might not want to have over to the house, but that's a part of your job as being a journalist. How could anybody in Boston, Chicago, New York, or Philadelphia have covered the mob if they didn't get to know all these colorful characters a little bit? Does that mean that they should go to jail without charge because they hang out with guys that have names from The Sopranos?
We don't even know the accusation, much less the truth, in the Hussein case. On the right-wing blogosphere, speculation abounds that he was not only a collaborator with the insurgency, but a mole planted in the AP to influence Western coverage of the war. But let's assume his motivations and actions were simply journalistic, to exploit his sources in the insurgency to get dramatic pictures of dramatic events. Still, ethical issues arise. Reporters are supposed to be, above all else, neutral observers, but they're also expected, under certain circumstances, to save human life at the expense of a story. Do you snap the picture or pull the wounded soldier to safety? And if the answer is saving the soldier, then would a reporter with advanced knowledge of a violent assault be obliged to warn its intended victims? Maybe, but in saving lives, he or she would have become a spy, putting all other journalists under suspicion. And if the reporter were an American, providing information about pending American military action to the enemy, he or she would most likely be deemed a traitor. In an upcoming program, we will be examining the conflicting values behind these ethical questions. But in the meantime, we ask you, to whom and what should a reporter be loyal? To one's news organization, to the story, to the audience, to one's country, to one's fellow man. Leave your comments at onthemedia.org under the headline, Battlefield Ethics.
Coming up, super fast internet access flies over the houses of the rich and lands in the projects of San Francisco.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Come January, the next president of the United States will have a desk full of issues, including some of ours, that is, media issues. Tim Wu is a professor of law at Columbia University and co-author of the book Who Controls the Internet. He recently wrote a piece for Slate laying out what should be the next president's technology priorities, including improving high-speed broadband internet access, sorting out the FCC, and using technology to reduce government secrecy. The candidates already are pondering some of these things. John McCain was quoted as saying, "When you control the pipe, you should be able to get profit from your investment." Not exactly what net neutrality activists want to hear. On the issue of broadband, a Hillary Clinton campaign press release states that she will, quote, "provide tax incentives to encourage broadband development in underserved areas." That sounds promising. And Barack Obama, who, by the way, is being advised by Tim Wu, says he will, quote, "set a goal of ensuring that every American has broadband access, no matter where you live, no matter how much money you have or don't have."
Right now, no one's fully in charge of anything. Congress kind of thinks it's a little bit to do with them because it's a form of infrastructure. The White House is in charge of science policy. FCC is in charge of communications. But really, there's no single entity who's making sure that America leads in this area. And the broadband czar would just be the single person whose job it was to make America the top broadband country in the world.
What keeps it from being that right now?
There's a bunch of things. There's a mixture of the private industry not necessarily wanting to invest. There's no clear regulatory structure as to what happens once you invest. There's very little government funding for investments. We fund all kinds of infrastructure like roads and swimming pools, but almost nothing for the internet. And so it's kind of caught in some morass of Washington confusion.
According to a World Economic Forum report that was just released on Wednesday, the U.S. ranks fourth in the world in internet infrastructure. Are we really lagging so far behind?
Depending on what listings you believe, America is either, you know, fourth or 17th or 20-somethingth in the world. The point is, usually the United States has led the world in communications infrastructure. And right now, everyone's complaint is that things just are not happening because there's a big knot in the world of broadband.
Why is broadband so important?
Broadband policy is becoming all of media policy and all of communications policy. In an age where almost every form of entertainment and news that we think about today is carried over a broadband connection.
Not to mention commerce and politics.
Right. Commerce, politics. These are all becoming broadband policy. How the broadband internet is regulated and what kind of capacity it has in the first place is now going to become the obsession of Hollywood, of Washington, New York, the whole country, as we discover what 21st century media policy looks like.
Concerning the FCC, you suggest completely rethinking how these commissioners are named. What is the problem as you see it with the FCC such as it's constituted now?
You know, America has the best tech industries in the world, and we sort of choose among a bunch of DC insiders as to who's going to be basically the coach of that team. I said in the piece, it's a bit like choosing coaches for the Olympic team from Nike's lawyers.
Fox is guarding the hen house?
You know, it is true that many people come in with industry loyalty. When you look at the breadth of talent in this country in technology and technology policy, we're picking from a very strange and small pool right now.
You suggest that the next administration should ensure greater governmental transparency using technology. Now, assuming the new president, you know, wants the government to be more transparent than the present one, what are the ways that technology can help advance that goal?
You know, this administration, when it came to opaqueness, was somewhere between Brezhnev and Dracula. And, you know, when people talk about real transparency, every candidate talks about it. What that really means is information technology. It means being able to search for things, to, for example, find where and what congressional hearing, who said what, in a way that doesn't require hundreds or thousands of dollars. We have seen huge reductions in the price of getting information in a lot of areas, thanks to search engines and other technologies. And the question is, how well can those technologies be used for government? This administration has just had the policy that everything is secret. And, you know, it's created a giant wall. And I think the only thing that can break down that wall is better information technology.
Now, considering you wrote a book called Who Controls the Internet, I'm kind of surprised you really didn't get into issues like net neutrality and privacy and security in your Slate piece. Do you have any recommendations for the next president on those issues?
The point of the Slate piece was to focus quickly on what the president can do to make things better as soon as possible. But over the long term, I think it's extremely important that the president and the FCC and Congress stay on top of net neutrality, reverse the horrendous infringements on American privacy that were the trademark of the last administration, and just start to think seriously about what privacy means in this age.
Now, I know in the Slate piece you were advising whoever the next president might be, but you have a clear choice. You're an advisor to Barack Obama. Is there some politicking going on here?
I think these are big questions for everyone, and these are just what I think should be done, and they don't reflect the views of the Obama campaign.
Well, Tim, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
Tim Wu is a professor of law at Columbia University and co-author of Who Controls the Internet?
Just a couple of years ago, municipal wireless internet access burst onto the scene full of promises. Like plumbing or electricity, we were told that Wi-Fi would soon be a 21st century urban expectation for everyone, everywhere. Wirelessness would foster entrepreneurship, a more educated and connected populace, and perhaps most important, a bridge across the divide between those who can afford to join the internet revolution and those who can't. Now, nearly all the plans for wireless cities have fizzled, including San Francisco's. But this week, at least a small part of that dream was salvaged by Brewster Kahle, director of the nonprofit Internet Archive. Welcome back, Brewster.
Thank you very much.
What you did was you turned on internet access Tuesday, last Tuesday, to approximately 260 apartments in the Valencia Gardens public housing project. Does this mean that they got access which they never had before?
Yes, the whole housing development got access to the internet, and everybody got it at 50 times the speed that a DSL or cable user would get. So it's the envy of San Francisco. The fastest residential internet access is to the least served individuals in San Francisco.
they're getting this super fast service. How?
The enabling technology, there's a couple of them. One is by having a housing system that has wires to the rooms, which is great. But San Francisco's also put in a municipal fiber. So the city itself owns a fiber that runs around to the schools, libraries, public housing, all through the city. And by our lighting that up, anybody that connects to that fiber is suddenly on the internet at super high speeds.
How much faster is it than the next fastest internet access?
Well, a DSL is usually 1 megabit or 2 megabits per second, and a cable modem, I've never seen them go over 5 or 6 megabits. This starts 20 times faster than that, at 100 megabits, and goes up to 1 gigabit, which is 10 times faster than that. This would even be the envy in Japan and Korea.
Are the residents of Valencia Gardens who don't have computers out of luck?
For people that don't have computers inside their units, there's a computer center that they can go down and use shared machines and also training. So it's really part of a full outreach program. Ours is just one piece of a set of nonprofits. Let's think of it as the rise of the .orgs.
Have any of the companies that provide competing internet access services, phone companies or cable companies, complained about what you were doing?
No. In general, everybody's looking at it fairly closely. They haven't found a model that works. What people tried to do, it seemed, is make it so that a Wi-Fi signal would make it into everybody's living room. And that's fantastically expensive. So we have to come up with a different idea. And the way that we did this, and the reason why we think it's going to work this time, is we're only going to do part of it. We're just going to do the backbone. And we can get the backbone built very inexpensively by just having a dozen sites around San Francisco that are well-located access points. Then if people can get to those with their own equipment or with, you know, ISPs going and saying, hey, I'm going to get your apartment building online on this system as well, that would be perfectly fine with us. There's enough money if you go and cut it that way that I'm hoping that the commercial guys don't try to shut us down.
So what you're hoping is that you can set the standard for the city. The commercial companies can come in after you and supply that last inch to the people who can afford to buy it, and they'll leave your housing projects alone.
Yes.
And they'll be enjoying better service than the San Franciscans who log in on Knob Hill. What does it mean that in this case, the last shall be first?
Isn't it the best? We could have done this for the rest of San Francisco, but the structures around our telecom infrastructure and cable infrastructure just haven't been really providing what it is the internet really could be doing, which is much, much higher speed, much more interesting services for everybody. And we needed some place to go and demonstrate it. And I'm very glad that it's actually in low-income housing.
Once you start serving the rich, is the competition going to suddenly start complaining or wanting to step in?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we're kind of given a free ride at this moment by the entrenched players because we're doing city services. So that allows us to get this fiber and not have that gun down. If we can go and cut this up right, then I think everybody's looking for a much bigger pie to share.
You run an organization called the Internet Archive, and its name explains it. You are trying to archive the entire internet, preserve every page. Is there any connection between that project and this one?
Absolutely. Our motto is universal access to all knowledge. And so we're trying to work with all knowledge by going and gathering the World Wide Web, digitizing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of books. We have movies, music. But how can we go and get all of these materials that are coming from libraries, the web pages, to everybody? And the idea of having gigabit networks throughout our cities, throughout our rural areas, are going to be crucial towards having the great library we're all building together be accessible at all.
Brewster, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brewster Kahle is the director and co-founder of the Internet Archive. Intimidation, wiretapping, intrigue, and big money. It's a story straight out of Hollywood. And in fact, it's a story straight out of Hollywood. Private investigator Anthony Pelicano is on trial in federal district court in Los Angeles. He's defending himself, no lawyer, against charges of intimidating reporters on behalf of his high-powered Hollywood clients. Say you're a bigwig worried about an unflattering profile about to run in a big magazine. Pelicano would allegedly make it go away, or try to, with methods that would earn two thumbs up from Billy Wilder. New York Times reporter David Carr watched the proceedings last week. Now he's back. David, welcome back to OTM.
A pleasure to be with you, Brooke.
As the story goes now, in 2002, Pelicano was accused of threatening LA Times reporter Anita M. Bush by having a fish and a rose placed in her car along with a bullet-sized hole in the windshield.
You can't make this stuff up, Brooke. I wish I had.
What do you mean you can't make it up? It's exactly like the horse head in the bed in The Godfather.
Except it's real.
Now, this was said to have been done for Pelicano client Steven Seagal, right?
You know, the agency of the threat is really difficult to track, but allegedly she had been pursuing a long-running story about Michael Ovitz and then a long-running story about Steven Seagal. And she found this dead fish, a rose, a bullet hole in the window. And then a Vanity Fair reporter, Ned Zeman, who was also doing a story about Steven Seagal, had some guys pull up next to him while he was driving and fire an empty gun and say the word bang and tell him to stop what you're doing. So it's kind of L.A. Confidential plus.
Now, Pelicano has only been charged in the Anita Bush incident, right?
He has been charged with multiple counts of wiretapping and racketeering with regard to the Anita Bush case and many, many others. It's been alleged that he engaged in a wholesale pattern of wiretapping to obtain confidential information that would advance his client's business or often marital interests. I mean, most of the clients came through Burt Fields, famed Hollywood attorney that represents many powerful folks. Chris Rock was a client. Brad Gray was a client. Michael Ovitz was a constant client.
So you're a big wig in Hollywood, and someone is out to get you. Either they're out to blackmail you into cutting a better deal, they're out to, you know, name you in a paternity suit. You've got somebody on you like white on rice. You call Burt Fields, this big-time Hollywood talent manager, and he connects you with Pelicano?
You either call Mr. Fields or you call Mr. Pelicano directly and you say, I have a problem. I'd like you to make it go away. And he is not going to fill you in on the details. But in fact, he may use a crooked Beverly Hills cop as he did. Craig Stevens testified that he pulled criminal motor vehicle records on over 100 people on his behalf. He may, in fact, do background checks on you in other ways that give his client leverage. Or barring that, he may rent an apartment in your zip code and it's alleged set up a phone tap so that your every move is known to his client.
Gary Shandling and Keith Carradine also made their way as witnesses through this courtroom, right?
Yeah, but they were victims. Gary Shandling was subjected to endless wiretaps. He kept trying to figure out how it is that the people he was negotiating with seemed to know his every move before he did, and turns out they were listening in on the line. For all I know, Mr. Pelicano's hearing this conversation as well.
But I guess the question for our listeners would be, why are we asking you about this, except for the fact that it's so delicious and wonderful? You write that the trial could serve as an accurate, if untidy, prism on the ethos of the modern entertainment business, to wit, you scratch my back, I'll stab yours.
What else do you want? I mean, this is how business is conducted in some parts of Los Angeles. Everybody smiles and wears beige and acts like they're in agreement, but when it comes down to it, they're using guerrilla tactics from the hills to gain any advantage they can. I think the reason that there are these black ops underway is that all of Hollywood has watched way too many movies about how business is done. And this is a movie brought to life where people engaged in behavior that's far beyond the ken, both federal and state laws, but many of them are going to end up living beyond consequence. So maybe it is a little bit of a movie.
So Pelicano goes through all of these hijinks. To what end?
Well, you have to give Pelicano some credit because he's living his values. He could have very easily thrown over his clients when the feds came for him. He was first charged with possession of explosives, served, I think, 30 months for that. And then just when he's due to get back out, they said, we're going to charge you with wiretapping. At that point, it would have been a simple matter for Mr. Pelicano to say, well, you know what? I didn't do this by myself. There's a lot of big people in Hollywood who made this happen. He did none of that. He has his own personal code of silence. He's made a decision that he's going to fight this tooth and nail. But when you're charged in a federal court and representing yourself, no less, there's not much chance he's going to get away. But a lot of other people have.
David, thanks so much.
An absolute pleasure. Good luck keeping this all straight, bro. No one knows, man. The thing is every cliche that you've ever seen in a Hollywood movie about skullduggery is there on display in an open federal court. It's breathtaking to walk into.
Thanks again.
A pleasure, Brooke.
Coming up, what happens when you just can't get all those talking heads out of your head?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The premise was simple. Gene Weingarten, a writer for the Washington Post magazine, spent an entire 24 hours simultaneously monitoring 5 TVs and 2 radios tuned entirely to political punditry. Rush Limbaugh, Keith Olbermann, you name it. And at the same time, he was online monitoring political bloggers. All this, for some reason, on Valentine's Day, wearing a tuxedo.
I was doing something nobody ever should attempt to do. For a period of 2 hours, I was listening to both Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly on separate radios at the same time. I don't know that that's ever been done before, but it definitely should never be done again.
Now, you observed that Bill O'Reilly is unhinged, but Rush Limbaugh, there's something about him that you actually found inspiring.
I'm not sure inspiring is the right word. He's very good at what he does. And when you listen to both of them, you realize how much better Rush is than Bill. O'Reilly is mean and self-righteous. And Rush Limbaugh is funny and mock heroic. He just doesn't take himself that seriously. At one point, he was speculating that the reason that most of the Democrats were going after Roger Clemens is that Democrats and liberals don't like great American institutions like baseball and the Boy Scouts. You know, he doesn't really believe that. He was just saying something that sounded funny and was funny. O'Reilly, no. O'Reilly is, you know, he's as funny as an aneurysm. So, yeah, I found myself really appreciating Rush Limbaugh. And that, after a while, that really got me angry with myself.
You observed that some of these pundits, the most extreme ones, like Michael Savage, have not tiny little niche audiences, but rather remarkably large ones.
I don't know if many of your listeners are familiar with Michael Savage. I was not. But this guy, he essentially, on the evening that I listened, was making the argument that liberals are all potential child molesters, and that if you are a conservative with a child, don't let them go over to a friend's house if the friend's parents are liberals. You know, and he's saying this seriously. This is, you know, this is not parody. And it turns out he gets 10 million listeners a week. You know, New York Times paper edition doesn't have 10 million readers a week.
Now, you identify yourself as a card-carrying liberal in the piece, but the extremity is not confined to the political right.
No. It was mostly confined to the political right until I had the honor of listening to Keith Olbermann. I only barely knew what Olbermann was up to, but he was as over the top as anyone else in the opposite direction. He was busy calling George Bush a fascist and comparing his stance on this relatively minor issue to the Alien and Sedition Acts. He was simply a sputtering lunatic, and I hadn't been ready to expect that.
So what's the underlying phenomenon here? Why do we pay attention to pundits who are unreasonable or extreme or polarizing or worse.
It's like hearing a drunk at a party. He rises above the babble, and you might hate what he's saying, but you can't ignore it. In a way, it's a cheap buzz. You know, why do people watch prize fights? Watch guys beat themselves raw and bloody until one thuds to the ground. There's a basic primal excitement in conflict.
One of the things you observed in your piece is that punditry, especially in the digital world, somehow manages to instantly create more punditry.
Yeah, I actually compared it to something Darwinian, in that somebody says something, that pretty much echoes it, changes it a little bit, and then eventually somebody says something that really goes off the track. That's like a mutation, and it winds up advancing the dialogue in a completely new direction. So it's evolution.
It's clear that at a certain point in this exercise, you lost your mind.
Well, you know, around hour 18 or 19, you just start losing your focus. You can't listen to all of it at the same time, so you focus on little things. And one thing that I wound up doing late at night, I was in the WashingtonPost.com office. No one was there. I decided to see what would happen if you turned the TV all the way up. Bob, you probably don't know how many little bars there are when you turn the volume all the way up on your television set. Those little volume bars, you know how many there are?
I have no idea.
There are 63 bars. And I was congratulating myself on that little insight when I realized something else. When the TV is blasting at full volume and some talking head is talking and he's trying to sound very serious, you can hear the intake of breath in between sentences. It's very loud and very clear. And if you listen to somebody only for the intake of breath, this person becomes a human being gasping for air. And you don't know what he's saying, which is great. And that entertained me for a good 10 minutes. And in hour 21, 10 minutes of entertainment is really, really great. But at the very end,
yeah,
it was 4 in the morning or something like that. I was listening to a pretty good show, and they were calling for people to send in Valentine's Day memories. They wanted text messages. So I got out my cell phone, and I sent them a very long text message. I described what I'd been doing for the last 22 hours and how I had lost virtually all my confidence in the human race. And I asked them if they could, as a Valentine's Day gift to me, just say nothing for 20 seconds. They didn't do it.
Gene, thank you very much.
Very good being here.
Pulitzer Prize winner Gene Weingarten writes for the Washington Post magazine.
Listening to talking heads is hard, but sometimes being a talking head can be even harder. CNN's got a workout this week when the Olympic torch suddenly vanished off the streets of San Francisco.
We have no clue where that runner is, where the entire delegation is. Obviously, a mystery underway right now in San Francisco. We don't see the torch. We don't see the runner. We don't know what's going on over there right now. We see something over there. I don't know if that's a real runner or with a real torch or somebody dressed up like that. Maybe this is the real runner. Maybe we finally caught up with the Olympic torch and maybe we know something.
For some journalists, especially ink-stained wretches, bloviating on TV can be an excruciating exercise. But now there's help. A Washington public relations firm offers the less-than-glib some tips on pumping up the palaver. A few years ago, we sent our own unassuming reporter John Solomon to pundit school, and he came back with this report. It's a painful but poignant tale, so we're playing it again.
I was once a promising TV pundit prodigy. At age 13, I appeared as an imposter on To Tell the Truth, the old game show where contestants who are not experts try to play one on TV. In my episode, I pretended to be a hot young painter.
Number 2, what is your name, please?
My name is Volodek Kos.
This black and white painting.
And to know enough about art to fool the celebrity panel, including Nipsey Russell.
All right, number two, do you do all abstracts or do you do some representational things?
I'm an abstract painter, but occasionally I'll do things that follow up a, what would you say,
In the midst of my abstract answer, Nipsey jumped in and rescued me.
I see. Who is your favorite painter, number two? I'm still talking with
Jackson
him.
Pollock.
I see.
I didn't convince Nipsey, but I did get panelist Bill Cullen's vote.
That is number two. I think number two has it very well thought out. And, that's not
and host Gary Moore seemed to hint at a limitless TV future.
The rest of us, too. What is your real name? What do you do?
My name is John Solomon.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. And the same goes.
However, it took me more than two decades to return to the tube. Fox News Channel invited me to talk about an article I had written for USA Today on a potential baseball strike.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Neil Cavuto, and this is Your World. My next guest says that a strike would be a good thing. He's John Solomon. He's a sports journalist right here in New York.
I say the sport needs a strike. Right now, they're negotiating really a very stopgap situation.
I was not invited back. So when the folks here at On the Media signed me to do a story about a Washington, D.C. company that was training journalists for TV punditry, I saw it as an opportunity to jumpstart a career that had peaked just before my bar mitzvah. On the train down, I heard someone a few seats back speaking on his cell phone. He said, "Well, Tina heard me talk about Enron at a dinner party and asked me to be on the show next week." Was there a real-life TV pundit aboard my train? I turned around. It was Joe Nocera, a longtime print journalist currently at the New York Times. Nocera moved into radio as a commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and now is a regular on TV. He tried to put me at ease about my own potential transition.
When people ask me why I'm so relaxed on television, I just say it's simple. The stakes are so low. What is there to be worried about? For so many of these shows, the audiences are pretty small because the knowledge required is so minimal, because this isn't always true, but a lot of times the hosts are idiots.
Now, Sarah quickly added that he wasn't referring to Tina.
Ladies and gentlemen, next station, stop over at Union Station, Washington, D.C.,
As Nocera and I walked off the train, the first person I saw was an old college acquaintance. I hadn't seen him since he was on TV as a legal pundit during the Clinton impeachment. He has since returned to real law and didn't want to be interviewed. As I continued through the station, I recognized yet another face from cable, Joe Watkins, a conservative co-host of CNN's Crossfire.
I mean, should you feel somewhat bad if you haven't been on TV and you're in Union Station?
They're everywhere.
A few weeks before, I had asked Watkins co-host Paul Begala whether a class at Pundit U could make a good Crossfire guest out of me.
No. Maybe you either got it or you don't.
If I had it, I would find it in the 1,000-square-foot mock TV studio located at the downtown offices of Corvus Communications. I was welcomed by my punditry professor, Rich Masters, a gregarious 42-year-old former rock disc jockey, local television reporter, and U.S. Senate aide, Natalie attired in a tan pinstripe suit and ostrich skin boots. Masters sat me down on a chair about 10 feet in front of a video camera. He fit me with an earpiece.
Yeah, this is a baseline. So feel free to screw it up so that you look really great when it's all done.
He then disappeared into a sound booth. Suddenly, Klieg lights clicked on from above. The next thing I heard was...
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Late Edition. John Solomon, will Tom DeLay survive?
I think Majority Leader DeLay's days are in fact numbered, and we should
I was in a spiral. And Nipsey Russell wasn't around to bail me out.
He'll be gone. He's doing as well as I am doing right now.
Well, I guess only time will tell. Thank you again, John Solomon, NPR, for joining us.
The Klieg lights were switched off.
That, just to show that was for the baseline, to really...
Thank you, very much. Perfect.
Next, Masters gave a PowerPoint presentation with some pundit do's and don'ts. Sample do. Prepare and practice in advance. For each likely question, create what Masters calls message diamonds, which should include your main point, then a lively anecdote, and finally the same point repeated in a slightly different form. Sample don't, a pre-show cocktail. Masters made that mistake himself and ended up inventing a new word, Authentication, live on Fox's Hannity and Combs. Now briefed and still sober, I return for another appearance on fake live TV.
Welcome back to MSNBC. Gun owners have long complained that they don't get a fair break from the media. National Public Radio's John Solomon went into the field to find out what the problem was.
After I finished explaining what the problem was, we went into a conference room to replay the tape so Masters could show me, on a huge plasma TV screen, what my problems were.
After the election, there was a big hue and cry about the fact that the blue state media didn't understand the red states. And one of the big issues was guns.
Masters froze the frame.
A couple things. Energy a little bit. As you can see from this, there's a need for makeup.
The plasma TV had also apparently sucked all the blood out of my alarmingly peaked face.
Because you can't control the sweating thing, but you can see you got a little bit of a 5 o'clock shadow. But you have a little bit of a head bobble thing, a kind of little bobblehead thing, but not as bad as I've seen a lot of folks have it.
He turned back to the screen and pressed the remote.
I think a lot of people view gun owners as people who are unsafe, but in fact, when you're around gun owners, you find that they're as concerned with safety because, in fact, they're going out hunting with their relatives or their family, and in fact, safety is paramount to them. So
I told Masters that at NPR we got a $10 bonus every time we use the phrase "in fact."
No, mine's clearly. I say clearly 1,000 times in a 2-minute deal. Word crutches, there's nothing wrong with them.
He said it gives you time to get ready for what you'll say next. But in fact, that was my biggest problem.
I realized that every time I added more, I got myself in trouble. Is that a common thing where kind of hit it nicely, you get a nice little double, and you go for the home run, and you start wandering, and you say, why did I add it? I was so doing well, or decently.
That's absolutely common. Television ain't splitting the atom. You want to get in and out. It's laser surgery, baby. You get in and out, and you just keep it as tight as you possibly can. When you feel that need to take it one step further, that's when you're going to end up rambling.
Master said I also needed to bring some of my personality on the air with me.
Oh, yeah. Sitting here, you've got just this great energy, engaging talk, and watch this. It drops off. Your energy level drops off a full quarter, if not more than that.
Because, in fact, there is much more common ground on this issue than has been portrayed in the press.
Thank you, John Solomon, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
The screen went black, and I awaited my final evaluation. Was I any good at this TV thing? I used to be.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. Tell you that.
So I was excited when Masters asked if he could use part of my performance as a model to show future students. Until I found out what part.
Majority Leader DeLay's days are in fact numbered, and we'll be
that would be a brain freeze. That's what we call the Solomon.
Still, Master saw enough potential in the full Solomon that he offered to pitch me to talk show bookers. It turned out I didn't need his help to get my next TV interview about another type of delay. The following morning, I was waiting in Union Station because brake problems had caused rail cancellations all along the Northeast Corridor, and a local television reporter was looking for reaction.
Live from the area's leading news station, this is News 4 at 4.
Amtrak's Acela trains are still out of service. Some passengers at Union Station this morning had to switch to regional service, which makes more stops.
So I upped my energy, answered concisely in message diamonds, and I had just shaved. Soon, I would no longer be the only one in Union Station not recognizable from TV. But alas, my interview didn't make it on air. A few days later, I got an email from Joe Nocera informing me that he too got bumped. At the last minute, Tina Brown had decided to switch the panel discussion from Enron to Michael Jackson. Well, Joe, I guess that's television. For On the Media, at least for now.
My name is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media, it was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.